Hello, everybody. Just a very quick one about Instagram. If you're on it, Meta, the parent company, is reducing the number of political posts visible to users on their feed. This is a real thing, not a hoax. So go to your Instagram profile, tap the three horizontal lines in the top right corner to open the settings tab, scroll down to what you see, click on content preferences, open political content, and turn on don't limit political content. That's an option. Otherwise, you won't see almost anything we post because we are deemed political. Please do that now, or you won't even see the posts about our shows, our fun things. So if you want to see Guilty Feminist content and know when we're coming to a place near you or releasing a new podcast, do it now.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm a feminist, but I don't know how to bleed a radiator, and I don't want to know how. Stick your passive-aggressive posters up your ass.
I'm a
feminist. Give a fuck.
I'm a feminist, but I'm not really sure what bleeding a radiator is. I don't know what's in it. I don't know what people are doing when they say
they're
bleeding
them. Leave it to the stepdads. I'm not interested.
But what even is it? Don't answer.
It makes your eating more efficient.
Yeah, no,
like,
that.
It's hypocritical. It's hypocritical.
But what's
if you care about the old planet.
Oh, no, I want someone to do it. Oh, no. I don't want my radiator is unbled because I know it matters to the environment and to the heat of my house. 100%
employer stepdad.
Yeah, but I don't want to do it myself and I don't want to know what the mechanism... I don't know really what's in a radiator.
I'm bored talking about it this long.
I'm a feminist, but if something unfeminist happens to me, I immediately write it in my notes on my phone because I need a lot of these, right? So anytime something I think, oh, that's an I'm a feminist, but I have to quickly jam it in my phone because otherwise I'll forget it, right? And then when I come to a show, I look in the notes and go, oh, yeah, that happened. I'm a feminist, but tonight I looked in the notes on my phone and it said, I'm a feminist, but Travis Alabanza, my glove box sounds like a euphemism for my vagina. And I have no idea what that means. But I carry them round and clearly Travis Alabanza and I were joshing. Something came up about my glove box. I don't have a car, so I don't know why.
No.
But
don't
Travis
need a car to have a glove box, am I right?
Travis.
No, it didn't work.
They still have glove boxes, even though no one wears gloves anymore.
That's true, yeah. No, that box is for Quality Street Collisions bars that you hoarded, knowing that they were a Christmas limited time item.
Yep.
And there are four in there, four in the boot, and four in a pink cabinet in my...
Yep.
And so that's not a euphemism either. There is a pink cabinet in my hall.
Well,
do you know what I'm talking about?
I know.
So, you know the best two Quality Street are the purple one and also the green triangle.
Oh, yeah.
They brought out a bar this year just for Christmas And it's a big bar where the bottom half is the green one and the top half is a miniature.
Stop it right now.
Yeah.
I'm going to need you to stop that right now. No
they
one told me about that.
Work on the PR for this. I'm doing it all for what? Free.
You never dropped me a text.
All I think about.
Well, would it have killed you to drop me a WhatsApp? With
I thought I was just spread. I just posted stories day in, day out.
I didn't see them, but this is a disappointment.
Well, you can't buy any anymore because I've bought them all in Southeast London anyway.
But I know if I break into your car, there'll be one in every orifice.
Yeah.
Of the car. Which now sounds like another euphemism for my vagina, and
we've
we're
got
back.
Glove box, pink cabinet, orifice of car, car orifice.
Yeah.
Oh, it's me.
Yeah.
I'm a feminist, but despite the fact that I consider myself to be liberal, egalitarian, and compassionate, mm-hmm. also, mm-hmm. on the other hand, these days, mm. I genuinely believe mm. that if you drop litter. You shouldn't be allowed to use the NHS. Suck it.
Wow.
Swivel. I mean it. Yeah, don't give a fuck. You shouldn't.
Seems like a popular move. I'm a feminist, but it's Martin Luther King Day, and I realise as it comes to an end... The only thing that I have posted about Martin Luther King Day is Hari Kondabolu saying, Hari Kondabolu being a brilliant comedian, saying, I also have dreams, quote, some white people when Martin Luther King was alive, MLK Day. Okay, his joke is really funny and I clearly didn't sell it well. Okay, all right. What Hari Kondabolu was saying was, white people, when Martin Luther King was alive, would have gone, but I also have dreams. You're not the only one with a dream. All lives matter. It's a really good joke that Hari's done there. Clearly, I should have done more proper MLK content, and I have failed to do that. And can I take this one back and do a different one? Because everyone hates it. This whole
hate's
room...
a bit strong. It just...
It hasn't landed?
It landed on its side. But it hasn't hurt itself.
I'm a feminist, but I often feel like I land on my side and I try and style it out.
Me too.
And tonight, I feel like the most feminist thing I can do is go, I've landed on my side.
Yeah.
I'm not styling it out. I'm not turning it into something it's not.
Yeah.
I am who I am. It is what it is. It's still January. There's still time for me to turn this puppy around.
I'm going to roll this puppy over.
I'm going to put this puppy on its feet and take it for a special little walk. A special little walk around a feminist block. This is what I'm doing. By the end of January, I will have taken that little puppy for a little walk around a feminist block. Up until it's only mid-January. I don't even have to have done anything good yet.
What are you worried about?
Well, I'm just saying, I'm very harsh on myself. Who else is harsh on themselves? Who else is kinder to other people in their minds than they are to themselves? Actually, you're my crew. All right. I'll meet you all in... the Snog Yogurt and Chalk Farm after this.
That's a place. That's not, again. She's not inviting me to her glove box. There's a shop called Snog Yogurt.
Snog Yogurt, yeah. I don't even know. I think the Chalk Farm one might be gone now.
I don't think this is a joke.
Go on.
I'm not sure what I was thinking. I've written it now. I'm a feminist, but despite the fact that I talk the talk about giving precious... little to zero shits about what I look like. That is a lie, because these days, it's probably a bit of perimenopause, but when I get stressed, just a chunk of hair just falls out of my head. And I care about it so much, it feels like someone's pulled a bit of my personality off. I don't know if you've read the Philip Pullman books, the Northern Lights trilogy. They've been around for a long old time, but in that, the characters have a daemon, and it's like an extended bit of their personality that's like an ethereal creature, and when it gets cut off occasionally, which is like the worst thing you could do to someone, and they're left like kind of lobotomized, essentially. Mm. I have a little moment of feeling... I have like such an enormous reaction every time it happens. I thought I'd just say it on here. There's no jokes in this. I just thought, actually, maybe that's something that's happening to loads of people. It's not full-on alopecia, I don't know. But, like, just a bit of hair will fall out, and I fucking care so much. And then I have a wave of shame and feminist guilt at caring so much at something that genuinely matters in no way.
Yeah.
What's not affecting anything? I'm so fucking lucky. How dare I care this much about something that at this point I can hide? Like, yeah, no joke, sorry.
No, honestly, it's not a lot of fun being a woman, is it?
No.
I mean, that I shouldn't feel bad about... I feel bad about my body because I've been patriarchally trained to. Oh, I shouldn't feel bad because now we've all got to love all of our bodies all the time. No, you don't have to love your body. You've just got to accept that it's a fact and not feel anything about it now, I've read. Oh, no, but I do want to love my body. Well, you shouldn't. Well, I tried, but now I can't. And I like, do I love it or I don't love it? And
well,
everyone
it's impossible,
on Instagram
isn't it?
Tells you
and
a
like,
different thing.
And they're like, well, aim for neutrality. And they're like, oh, I forgot to look in a mirror for a month. Yeah. It was nice, but I've turned up with fucking 8 twigs in my hair, fucking bit of lipstick around my fucking nostrils. Like, where's the line? I did write a joke. What's awful, I think, about the hair falling out is how cruel is it that it's stress that causes it, but it happening makes you feel so stressed. It's like developing a peanut allergy that presents as your lips turning into a Snickers bars. It's not my greatest work, but I couldn't leave the whole bit on just an earnest sentiment.
No. I get it. Live from King's Place in London, the Sponsored Ada Shop presents The Guilty Badness with me, Deborah Francis White, guest co-host Jessica Foster, and various special guests, Dr. Kirsty Sedgman, talking about being unreasonable. Now, if you're listening to this episode, what you won't know is we recorded another episode tonight where comedian Olga Koch taught us how to make goals and stick to them. And basically, you lie and say you've already done it. So we call this Olga Koch's I've already done it. I haven't really, but now I've said it, I have to do it. I told the audience in the interval to say to each other, I've done it, yeah, like this morning. Yeah, actually, funny enough, this morning I sent off for the application for my master's. Or you could say, actually, this morning I received a letter saying your master's is through. I mean, you don't have to fully lie to everyone you know to play this game. You can play it where they know you're playing it, or you can say, yeah, I've already done it. You know, so what I wouldn't say is I've just been elected MP for Kensington Chelsea, and then they find out and they think you're a liar. But if you said, I've called up to ask about what I'd have to do to run for my local council, thinking, well, I haven't, but if I say I have, it'll be really awkward when they go, well, did you hear back? Or you could even say, I've got a meeting about it. And then you have got a meeting about it because you're quickly going to get a meeting about it so you don't look like a liar. So that's the idea. But here we can play big. So you can say whatever you'd fucking like, okay? Because we all know you're playing the game. If everyone knows you're playing the game, I think you can play it as wildly as you want. Okay, all right. Who has got one that they would like to do? Great. What's your name?
Phoenix.
Excellent. Big round of applause for Phoenix.
We have taken our political burlesque show to Edinburgh.
How did it go?
It was amazing. Everyone loved it.
Excellent. And your political burlesque show, what's it called?
Stripping in the Name Of.
Stripping in the Name Of. Wow. And so it's a political burlesque show, like a feminist burlesque show?
Yeah.
Excellent. And off the back of Edinburgh, have you got any further runs booked now?
Well, we'll probably go to America.
You probably go to America.
I think we're going to do a guest spot at your show in Edinburgh as well.
Oh, yeah. You're doing a guest show?
Yeah.
Did you know they're not telling you? Of course you are. I know about that. Well, it's great that you've already inquired about booking an American tour. That's fantastic. Well done. Stripping in the Name Of. Big round of applause for. Anyone else got one? Something I've already definitely done. Just hand the mic back there. What's your name?
Natasha.
What have you already done, Natasha?
I've just been offered a highly paid, socially conscious, feminist job in Australia, and I'm moving there next year.
Wow. What's the job?
Involves growing vegetables and reforming agriculture to make it better for the environment.
Wow, what a fantastic thing to be doing, definitely. I love that, and it's really going to change the world, and it's going to change how you feel about your place in the world. So it's such a wonderful thing, and I'm glad it's already sorted. And I look forward to next time you come along to the show, I look forward to hearing about how that's moved on.
I'm excited.
Great. Anybody else? Who else wants the mic? Yes, go.
Hi. I just managed to get a producer for my new screenplay about a woman who doesn't want to have children.
Oh, a screenplay woman, and you've got a production company lined up. Are they any good?
Yeah, they're wonderful, and we're gonna go global with this. Mm. It's gonna be great.
Have they made anything that's won anything or that we would have heard of?
They made The King's Speech.
Oh,
wow! They made The King's Speech.
Is that Left Bank? I feel like that might be Left Bank. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. That's absolutely great. Anybody else? Anybody else got? Well, so many successful people. Yes, great.
I'm actually over my ex. Actually. Yeah, I'm not in love with him anymore, I've just realised that I do deserve better. Yeah.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. Yes, you do, and yes, you are. Yes, you are. Anyone else got some people? Someone had one there. Just shout yours out, and I'll say it into the mic. I've got a meeting with the BBC and Netflix. Yes.
About
your book. They want to do what? A bid. They want a bid for it. Your book about moving to the UK.
Restarting
your life.
43
master student taking over the world. So your love and life. Okay. So you've got a meeting with the BBC and Netflix about turning your already published book into. Presumably a show or a movie, probably whatever you want. I mean, I think they really want it, so you can probably set that. Yeah, I'm so excited for you. That's absolutely amazing, and I look forward to seeing it. I think it's please. Oh, sorry. Yeah, there are quite a couple of scripts on my table, but I can't wait to read it, and I'm sure I'm going to love the part. And Jess Foster Key.
I got a part in it as well, did I? I think I had a part in it. Did I have a part in it, but like not as a... I'm your fiancé. Amazing. Incredible. But and as your fiancé in, do I get... And I probably get to play something other than a social worker or a security guard. Or a tired mum. Oh, I'm just playing myself. Okay. So it's like, oh, okay.
Okay.
I think I can do that.
What other parts have you got this year, Jess?
Oh,
coming up.
I have got some.
What are you playing?
All of that aside, an amazing. My turns out my son's a feminist.
Thank you very much, and that's Olga Cox game. I've said it, so it's true. Thank you very much.
Lovely game.
It's a good game, isn't it?
It really filled my cockles.
I think the informal name of it is I'm Over My Ex.
Yeah, that was
Let's an play I'm Over My
mic
Ex.
Drop. Let's play so I'm Over good. My Ex.
This is The Guilty Feminist, the podcast in which we explore our noble goals as 21st century feminists and the hypocrisies and insecurities which undermine them. I'm Deborah Frances White. With me is Jessica Foster Cube, and we are talking about being unreasonable. And I have a little story I want to share with you.
Yum.
Okay. I booked some dental work in for a chosen family member that I was like, right, we're getting this sorted. It's a present from me let's call it a birthday present. I mean, obviously, I will give them a proper present as well, because who wants root canal for their birthday? But I was like, you're in pain, and dentistry work's really expensive. Yeah. You don't get a lot on the NHS. And I was like, we're just doing it all. But it was going to be quite a lot. So I rang the receptionist, explained the whole thing, and said, can I, you know, dental work's very traumatic. Mm-hmm. People don't necessarily want to go. If he's only seen for this and not for that, he might not go back, all of that. So I had a long chat to the receptionist, really understanding and sympathetic, and got that I was, don't, please don't bill them, bill me, and so on and so on. Anyway, had to ring back to change the appointment, so on and so on. So we really had bonded by this point. Then she says, I'll send you a payment link, and if you've got to pay 50 quid to hold the appointment. And I was like, great, this is really important that it happens. I'll pay it straight away. Did pay it straight away. The next day, I got a text saying, you haven't paid, so we've cancelled the appointment. Oh. And I was really upset. And I rang up and I said, hey, I definitely have paid. I've got a text from you saying I've paid. And I've got the receipt that, you know, they send you like an email receipt or whatever. I've paid and you've cancelled my appointment. And she said, well, it's not here under the name. And blah, blah, blah. I said, but I did say different name, appointment name to credit card name. And she immediately went, and I just said, I don't think this is a very good process. Like, I think you should text people first if you don't pay by this point. Mm-hmm. If you have paid, let us know. And if you don't, I think that could be that would be a better text to send. And I was a little bit upset, but it was more I was upset for the family member thinking, oh no, it's going to get cancelled and they've taken time off work. And I was just like, yeah, agitated. But I wasn't.
Makes it more stressful than it
was. I wasn't cross with her. I was saying, I don't think it's a very good process because I assumed it was like an automatic text. And she said, well, I'm happy to cancel the appointment. And I went, but what? Why would you cancel the appointment? I said, no, I really want the appointment. And she said, well, I've asked for what the other name on the credit card was. And she was really, like, immediately went into, I'll cancel the appointment, you know, you're being rude to me, blah, blah. And I said, look, I'm not being rude. I'm saying I don't think it's a very good process. And I said, I think it's rude to charge someone 50 quid, send them a receipt, and then say they haven't paid, and you're going to, like, what if I hadn't seen this text? He would have turned up. I have paid for something. You're not even refunding it to me. I have to chase after you to get a refund. Like it is your error. And as much as, you know, I'm not blaming you personally, but I feel like it's not a good process. And that's all I was saying. Anyway, she eventually just said, well, I'm going to hang up on you now. And I had sort, I de-escalated enough to sort it. And at the end, I just said, I just think it's nice to say sorry if, you know, made an administrative error. And I really was saying, I'm not blaming you, but I just think it... Basically, I was saying, I think we got off on the wrong foot here and it escalated. Gave her that opportunity. And she said, well, I'm hanging up now. So I then wrote an email and said, could I please speak to the practice manager? And I got an email back saying, what would you like to talk about? And I just said, oh, it's just a customer service thing. And I got an email back saying, okay, you're probably going to have to send pictures of your teeth.
What?
Well, she didn't know who I was. And I didn't know it was her either. We both didn't know we were talking to each other. Because then I wrote back, I said, no, I had this and this and this happen. I didn't say what it was. I just said an upsetting customer service experience. Mm. And she wrote back and said, well, that was with me, so I can't really help you with that. But the practice manager's away till next week, so you can talk to a senior dentist. I said, or we can defer the appointment. I went, no. I said, I just need to know that they're going to be treated with respect and professionalism. And, you know, I'll chat to the practice manager next week. Anyway, she said, yes, I can make sure of that. Anyway, I had a lovely, lovely, lovely chat to the practice manager the following week. And I said, look, here's what I think happened. I think probably being a receptionist is quite hard, and especially when people are in pain with their teeth. Possibly, probably, someone had been rude to her or snapped at her or shouted at her because they hadn't paid for their appointment and got cancelled, and she was having a really bad day. And it just felt like another in a series of people blaming her. But I know that I said process, and I know, because I sometimes work with corporate people around how to de-escalate these things, I said, I know that I said it's process. And I was a bit upset, but I definitely wasn't shouting. I wasn't raising my voice. I wasn't sweary. I was just going, hey, I feel really upset that, you know, you and I had a long conversation about this person. So you knew. She said at the time, well, my colleague called you yesterday. And I said, I did get a missed call, but from an unknown number and no message. So then you need to just, if you can send a text saying it's cancelled, you can send a text saying, have you paid? And if you haven't, please pay. Otherwise, we're going to cancel it. Anyway, our practice manager said, look, I don't want to get anyone in trouble. She's probably had a really bad day, but I would like to talk to you about process, and I'd like to talk to you about how she can de-escalate things if a customer's upset, because I had told her it was going to be a lot of work, and this practice manager owns the practice, and I said, it's going to be thousands of pounds. And I said, so I think you would not want me, because I could have just hung up and gone, I'll go somewhere else then. Yeah. But I didn't, because I'd read all these amazing reviews and it was in the right place and everything. Anyway, the practice manager was so nice and said, I'm so sorry it's happened. And I said, look, could you just tell her, it'd be really nice if she just said, even if she just says, I'm sorry, we got off on the wrong foot. She went, I will, because, you know, and let me get to the bottom of it. Anyway, they've since gone in and had their their starter for 10.
Yeah.
And I've since had the receptionist messaging. She's never said sorry. She's never said sorry, and the work's all booked in her way. And I just desperately want her to say, oh, I'm sorry about the other day.
That's not unreasonable.
I am so livid.
Even if she is personally raging and doesn't believe that she's sorry, in a professional context like that, if it's exactly as you described, she needs to eat shit and say sorry.
But that's what life... There's so many times in life where you're like, well, actually, as part of my job...
Yeah.
...is to fucking apologise when I fuck my job up.
Well, but what's her side of the story? Because she must
have
one.
Whether you had a good reason for having done it or not.
But this is the thing, is you're only hearing my side of the story. I bet her side of the story is a really rude woman.
Yeah, I had the worst day ever.
Shouting at me. And it wasn't my fault. Well, I didn't know that the credit card had a different name. She did, because I told her it would be a different person. But anyway, let's not dwell on it. But I was just like, it's a payment link. It shouldn't need to be the same name. It's a payment link. It's been paid. Anyway, I thought I did such a good job of saying to the dentist, please tell her,
I was in that situation.
We all have bad days. These things happen. Everyone screws up. I'm sure I've acted unreasonably because I've been in a bad way at that exact point in time and I've just had enough. It happens to everyone.
When I end up in phone calls like that, Debs, I'm far less contained. You have been reasonable. I've got no filter. In situations like that, when I'm going round and round in circles, and it's like, okay, I've hurt my feelings, you've hurt your feelings. Yeah. Can we fix the problem, though? Yep, but can we fix the problem, though? Okay, I'm going to list everything I can think of to be sorry for, and now can we fix the problem, though? Once I've done about three of them, I just start saying what I really feel.
Right, yeah.
I start saying things like,
do you want...
This is making me want to self-harm.
Does...
I mean... Making noises like that at her.
Well, that is how I feel. I'm sure her story is, some title...
You're making me want to kick a dog!
Do you know the funny
if
part?
If I develop an addiction, it's today! You did that!
I mean, the funny part of this is one of the things that the practice manager, who is the senior dentist there as well, said to me is, we got chatting, and she asked me what I did, and I told her, and because I was talking about maybe getting a little bit of, just... these teeth have shifted, and I said, maybe it braces. I said, I wouldn't really care, but sometimes I perform on screen and I really notice it then, and I know that's a bit vain and blah, blah, blah. And she said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a comedian. She went, oh God, we've given you a lot of material, haven't we? And I went, no, I would never. I haven't named it. I can't name it. They've got really good reviews. Let's not,
Be able to find them from the fact that they've got really good reviews. There's no way anyone could ever identify the dental. No.
I really want to say to this receptionist, because it's going to be a long relationship, right? Because this person in my chosen family has to go for loads of different things. Yeah. And now I really loved the practice manager. I want to go in. Do I say to the practice manager, it's really bothering me that she's never just reached out and said, sorry, even if it's just like, sorry, we got off on the wrong foot, which I've given her that out. I've said she can just say, sorry, we got off on the wrong foot, so that I feel comfortable about coming in. But I've talked about now having a little bit of work there. I'm like, it's...
No, you're not having a little bit of work there.
Should I write back? But I love the practice manager. Should I write to the receptionist and just say, hey, it bothers me?
Or I think hey is too informal. You keep opening these things with hey. What? That's how Steph says hey when I wake up in the night freezing and I take the covers back. She goes, in her sleep, hey. You can't, you've got to be more empowered than a hey.
I say anything, or should I just let it the fuck go? Because I'm one of the...
Bitch.
Okay, I should let it go, shout Frozen. And if you think I should take action, shout Action. Okay.
Action!
Action!
Okay,
oh, just see the Frozens.
Frozen!
Action.
Action!
Oh, there's more Frozens. Okay, I'm letting it go. On the, I have to listen to my audience, otherwise who am I? All right. Jessica Fostercue, will you do some stand-up for us?
Okay.
Please welcome to the stage the incredible Jessica Fostercue.
Okay, so it's some very recent thoughts. I don't know if they're funny. I was going to say it and I don't care, but I do. I hope they are. Okay, so I posted a... I'm posting reels of old stand-up on Instagram at the moment in a more prolific way than I would normally because I have a tour to promote. And I posted a reel at the start of the year on purpose with an old bit of stand-up I did, which I still stand by now, about the diet industry. And the gist of it is... this is a short... Okay, anyway, it's basically 98% of diets, restrictive diets, eating diets, don't work. 98%. So it's not your fault if you couldn't stick to one. 98% of people couldn't. Which means it's safe to say, as a thing, if 98% of the thing doesn't work, it doesn't work. They don't work. If 98% of cars didn't work, you wouldn't fucking get in one, would you? Let alone buy and get in a new one every single Monday and go... What's wrong with me? And I posted this at the start of January because of all the horrible noise in the world to try anyway at these things. And the reel does quite well. What can I say? It's diet season, aka the month of positive festive shame, post festive shame. And with all the pleasure that comes of a reel doing well, inevitably comes a bit of pain. And sure as eggs is eggs, my comments and my DMs fill up with a lot of, actually all in this instance, if they are who they're. Profile looks like they are white, cis, thin or athletic men desperate to explain to me that ha 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 nice joke, but obviously diets do work. That's just thermodynamics. And they all explain to me, thank God for these men. Thank God. I mean, they all just explained. They said, if less calories go into your body than you burn, you lose weight. Bang. Science. Fact. Psych. Calories in versus calories out. Mic drop. 40 years. I didn't. What have I been doing? I'm gonna have to tell the other heavy people. Oh my God. And it got me thinking, right? And it got me raging, and then it got me thinking off the back of the simmering, when the rage went from boiling down to the simmering. On the surface of it, how can you argue with that, calories in versus calories out? That is just science, right? Wrong! Because as soon as you begin to consider any sort of context at all, it fails to work. And for me, it's similar to saying, the faster you drive, the quicker you'll arrive. You kind of can't argue with it on paper. It's a lovely soundbite. The faster you drive, the quicker you'll get there. Science. Until you consider any sort of context at all. Take any look quicker than a blink at this, and you'll realise that sentence only works if there is only one road to take. It's a totally straight road with no bends, no bumps or imperfections at all. There are no other vehicles, no roadworks or indeed pavements, humans, animals, buildings, God forbid schools or parks or events, no other occurrences anywhere near the road. It's just a dead straight road in a void in space and time with zero obstacles or distractions of any sort. Weather doesn't exist. We've all got exactly the same car that's in exactly the same condition. We've all got the identical driving skills to one another, the same experience of driving, and all our bodies and minds are in exactly the same condition. And the same day, the same mood, same energy and focus capacity, same eyesight, same everything. Yeah, right, it's as simple as that. The faster you drive, the quicker you'll arrive. It's actually, as soon as you... Anyway. So get fucked, is it as simple as calories in versus calories out? Get fucked to the 98% of people who can't maintain a lifetime in calorie deficit and hunger and misery with their bodies fighting them all the way, the ones who are somehow failing or in the wrong at this time. Fuck every single one of those bros with their one-sentence solutions, not quite the flex they had intended. Just raging, really, rather than comedy. But I think, and we'll talk about it a bit with our guest, I think, but when this sense of injustice of somebody comments on something, the desperation you feel to comment back, and actually, like, it is the greatest act of self-care that you can do, actually, to choose Frozen, I think, actually. Just let it go some of the time, or wait till you've mood's got to simmering point and write a rant that you are, if you're privileged enough to be invited on a lovely podcast, you can do a sort of reply all.
Amazing. Amazing.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hello, Guilty Feminists. This is Deborah. You have got one last chance to see us in London before I am off on tour to Australia and New Zealand. We will be at King's Place on the 10th of April, where Alison Spittle will be co-hosting. Now, we've got a very important episode. We've talked briefly on the podcast already about what's happening with reproductive justice in this country and abortion rights. There are currently three bills, anti-abortion bills, of varying degrees in the House of Lords at the moment. There's a two-way push for and against abortion rights creeping in that we are not really paying attention to. So we have a panel of experts, including Felicia Jung from Reproductive Justice Initiative, to talk about that. We also have some other great guests talking about a brand new study about refugees in work, and that's also going to be amazing. But I would like as many people as possible to come out because we need to be talking about, thinking about, campaigning about abortion rights in this country. France has just put it into their constitution. We don't have a constitution. We will have a section for Q&A, so you can specifically ask our panel of experts what to do, what's going on, and what's going to happen next. For tickets, go to kingsplace.co.uk and search for Guilty Feminist, or go to guiltyfeminist.com and go on live shows. Our tour Down Under begins, and we can announce our amazing co-hosts for these shows on the 11th of May in Auckland, the 14th of May in Wellington, and the 15th of May in Christchurch. I'm going to be co-hosting for the first time with the incredible stand-up comedian from Aotearoa, Michelle Acourt. I know she's huge in New Zealand and a massive feminist, and I'm very, very excited. We tried to work with her before, and her daughter very inconveniently gave birth that night. I can't think of a more feminist reason not to come. So we're very, very excited. Then we'll be in Adelaide on the 18th of May with Geraldine Hickey. After that, we're coming to you, Perth, on the 20th of May with Claire Hooper. Then we'll be in Sydney on the 23rd of May with Geraldine Hickey. And then we'll be in Melbourne on the 25th of May. I am not allowed to say who the co-host is, but she is a big Australian favourite and she's amazing. I am not allowed to announce her yet because she's so famous and fabulous. And the guest is an A-list Australian star. Again, we're just getting permission to announce her. So I would recommend, if you're in Melbourne especially, Our tickets are going fast everywhere, but I would recommend if you're in Melbourne especially, you get your tickets now before the announcement is made, because you are going to want to see these people. And we also have some incredible activist voices and other special stuff going on. The last two dates are in Brisbane on the 27th of May with the wonderful Alice Fraser, and in Canberra on 28th of May, we end the tour with Kirsty Wiebeck. Grace Petrie's coming out and she's doing all the dates with me. We're also going to have poets, activists, incredible guests. It's going to be, do you remember how buzzy the tour was last time and everyone was hysterical at the end? It's going to be like that again. So do not miss out. Get tickets now at guiltyfeminist.com and click on live shows. You can also get an ad-free version of the podcast from Patreon, Apple Podcasts or Acast Plus from as little as £2.50 a month. And that really helps to support the podcast and pay all the wonderful people who support me in bringing you The Guilty Feminist every week. You can also show support in a way that costs you nothing by going to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and giving The Guilty Feminist a 5-star review, even though you've done it before, because it really, really helps other people find us in a very crowded market with a weird algorithm pushing people further to alt-right content every week. And so we'd really, really love it if you'd tell people about it, share it online. And now back to the podcast.
Our guest today is an award-winning scholar who has spent her career studying how we construct and maintain competing value systems, working out how people can live side by side in the same world, yet come to understand it in such totally different ways. In her new book, On Being Unreasonable, she examines the outdated rules fraught with discrimination and unfairness that shape our society. Please put your hands together and make incredible whooing noises for the wonderful Dr. Kirsty Sedgman! Come join
Welcome.
Us. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming. Do you have any I'm a Feminist buts?
I do.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Come on.
So I'm a feminist, but yesterday I posted a thirst pic of myself on Twitter so that I could poll my followers on whether or not I'm cool enough to pull off wearing a waistcoat. And the poll options were for respectfully, in parentheses, for disrespectfully, meh, and oh, sweetie, no. And I teach survey design at university. But I should say, it was a thirst pic. What I really mean is it was mildly dehydrated voting.
What did they vote? What did they go for?
They tended to vote for a respectful for, so I will
very
be buying a waistcoat.
Nice. Very nice.
I'm a feminist, but I would want a disrespectful for.
Yeah, I'm a feminist, but I'd be like, sort of annoyed about the respect.
Indeed. Kirsty, you've written a fantastic book here about, it's called On Being Unreasonable.
Yeah.
And on the back it says, the social contract is collapsing. We're living in an age of division. Bad behaviour is everywhere. How do we figure out what's right in a world gone wrong? Why can't we all just be reasonable? And you're an academic. I was fascinated by the introduction because you tell a story about how you came to sort of think about this in a personal way. Any chance you'd read that to us now?
Of course. So it was December 2014, and I was sitting on a bench in the jewellery room of the V&A Museum, sweating profusely because my entire upper half, from the top of my head down to my waist, was entirely covered by my thick woolen coat. And inside the coat, I was struggling to cram my nipple into the mouth of my three-month-old baby, Monty, in order to achieve what the midwives called a good latch. I'd chosen that space because it was dark, there was something padded to sit on, and I was desperate because Monty's cries had been revving up fast. And around us there was a swarm of posh, older white visitors who were pretending to look at the jewels in their cases, but actually tutting and staring askance at the strange woman hiding under a coat in the middle of the room and muttering to each other and asking, should we call security? And now, I don't know how many of you have ever breastfed a baby, but it is brutal. So pre-children, this is how I thought it worked. Step one, cradle baby in arm. Step two, with other arm, veil maternal bosom in modest cotton cloth. Step three, pop nipple out, point towards baby. Step four, breastfeeding accomplished. But in reality, in my experience at least, it usually went a bit more like this. So step one, clutching baby, peel nursing bra slowly down step two. Oh God, it turns out that the bra was the only thing holding the milk in. Milk is now shooting out everywhere. Step three, clutching nipple in one hand and baby's neck in the other. Carefully bring them together. Step four, quick as a flash, ram nipple into baby's mouth at precise 45 degree upward angle so enough breast tissue gets over his hard palate before he clamps down. Step five, ow, not fast enough. Ow, ow, he's chomped the tip. Step six, gritting teeth retreat. Then try again. Step seven, after a few goes, get it about right and then have to sit there exactly rigid, completely still, so that the latch doesn't slip and leave me white and cracked and bleeding. And then step eight is repeat steps 1 to 7 with boob number 2. Now, I didn't realise it at the time, but at that exact moment, just a few miles down the road, 40 other women were standing outside Claridge's hotel feeding their own infants. And there were no woolen modesty blankets for them. Just a bunch of signs saying things like, that's what breasts are for, stupid. And in future, I'll be taking my breast at the Ritz, was my personal favourite. And that storm in a D cup was part of a nursing protest that was organised by breastfeeding campaigners, prompted by something that had happened shortly before, where a woman in Claridge's had been asked to cover up her baby with a white tablecloth, and she posted that to Twitter. Nigel Farage got involved, and that's when it really hit the headlines, because he said, and I quote, surely it's not too hard to breastfeed in a way that isn't overly ostentatious. And because I study discourse, I study language use in action, I became fascinated with this story. So I read all the comments below the line on all the articles, including the Daily Mail, and watching the debates unfurl online, I saw so many of my fellow citizens frothing at the mouth over the idea that they might need to share, one day have to share a space with women, quote, unceremoniously plonking their breasts on the table, left, right, and centre. Now, I know that they're often called jugs, but I think they were getting a bit confused there. But what I really noticed reading all this is how often one word kept coming up over and over again, and that was the word reasonable. Because Claridge's requests were actually very reasonable for some people, because many people may potentially be embarrassed at the sight of somebody feeding a baby. It was unreasonable for that mother to take it for granted that everyone would find it acceptable. As most reasonable thinking people know, breastfeeding can be done discreetly. And Farage's statement, a lot of people agreed, was also really reasonable because he was only calling for compromise and accommodation on both sides. So I started thinking about what it means to be reasonable and how difficult it was for me in that set of circumstances, finding breastfeeding actually extremely difficult, to breastfeed in a way that everybody would consider to be reasonably discreet. And if everyone is drawing that line in a slightly different way, then how common can common sense really be?
Amazing. Thank you for that, Kirsty.
Thank you.
I remember breastfeeding in a cafe once, and a friend had given me a shawl, and I had never tried it before. And up until that point, I hadn't felt self-conscious breastfeeding in public. But I put the shawl on, and then I did feel self-conscious because it was huge. And I overheard a child ask its parent, why is that lady dressed as a ghost? and from then on, I got my bosoms out. But how do we evolve shame around breastfeeding in public? Surely that's something that we've cultivated in terms of society. Was it Victorians? That's my guess.
That's a good guess. And actually, that's one of the things that I write about, because what I really wanted to find out is the roots of what we consider to be reasonable behaviour when we're sharing space with other people. Mm. And when it comes to the idea that women should be modest and discreet and covered up, in the Anglophone context at least, it's often believed that we owe that to the Victorians. That was definitely my assumption. But when I dug into the research, I found that that division actually has roots in much older traditions. Like, for example, Aristotle, he reflected on the ideal split of Greek society into the home and the city. And throughout the centuries, the demand placed on women has been to artificially enhance their bodies in private to appear naturally beautiful, whilst pretending we're not doing anything at all because we just woke up like this. So it's small wonder, really, that some people still see feeding a child or maybe even applying a slick of mascara on public transport, which is one of the other things that I look at. People can be really upset about women applying makeup in public. It's small wonder that because we've been fed this line that women have to appear naturally beautiful and cover up and be modest and not show too much of themselves, that those things are still seen as a scandalously private act.
How? So we've ended up with what you talk in the book about, the social contract, which is what we sort of all expect. So something I would expect in the social contract, which I never really think about until it's crossed.
Yeah.
So if I'm on a tube and...
You're right.
Okay. And there's lots of seats and someone gets on and sits right next to me.
Thought you'd breach the contract just by getting on the tube. They're fainted.
Is everything okay?
Yeah, great. Okay.
If somebody sits right next to me when there are, like, say the carriage was empty except just for me and this person, they sat right next to me that would be a grave crossing of the social contract or discounting of the social contract, which would make me fear, like, what's going on here? Because that's not normal, right? And, like, no one's ever given you a lecture and told you don't sit next to somebody if there's a seat, if there's lots of... We don't talk about.
Also, that person might be... That person potentially, I don't know, is from a culture, like, we're in London, we're so, like, not look at the person.
Yeah, no, absolutely, but in...
And they might be from somewhere where, on public transport, of course, it'd be rude not to, and they're going to try and be
your friend. Yeah, would imply that you want to be avoided or whatever. But those kinds of things, we often don't know what our social contracts are until they're contravened.
Yeah.
So in terms of an academic, philosophical view of all this, can you unpack that a little bit more for us?
Of course. So one of the things that I write about is how our distinction between private and public and intimate space actually has been found to vary quite wildly from culture to culture. And, of course, there is no quantitative measure. There's no one singular centimetre point at which we've all decided to agree and told our children that this is the point where you're crossing over from public space into somebody's personal space. But we all register those things, and it's because of what we call supraconscious mechanisms, which is the fact that a lot of what we know about the world comes down from top-down instruction, but a huge amount goes beyond consciousness and language. We aren't told how to behave. One of the things that I look at is how do we know how to cue?
British people know. Australians don't know in the same way. We don't know.
No, we don't know.
I had to observe because I was like, I was so confused when I first got here. People will queue for the bus stop, but they're all getting on different buses.
Yeah, and it seems so simple.
It's not normal.
But just think about what happens when you need to grab something else and you have to not leave the queue, but just slightly move away from the queue. How do you signal to other people that you're definitely not leaving the queue? I do a kind of exaggerated lunge, much as you were demonstrating earlier. Nobody taught us how to do these things.
A Diane from Traitor's Lunch.
Yes.
A Diane from Traitor's Lunch.
And just a bodyweight lunge.
If that was,
that was done
in this episode, listeners, but Jessica Foster Q did tonight live on stage lunge. And so you would do an exaggerated lunge.
I would. Yeah. But we just know how to behave because we feel these rules in our bodies and under our skin, which is why it can be so irksome when we feel that somebody else is breaking the rules, especially if they're not just getting away with it, but benefiting. So when we're thinking about the social contract, we need to think about the rules of behaviour that really are benefiting all of us collectively, because they're making public space better. And social life better, safer, fairer, more equal for everybody. But also, when have those rules been made up to privilege only a certain slice of society and to keep the rest of us down?
One of the things there is that I think sometimes neuroatypical people would go, but why? Why not just say, or why not do this? The assumption should be that if I come back, I should be... Well, I don't know, I'm just making that up, but for every individual, it'll be different. But someone from a different culture, like when I got here from Australia, I was like, what the hell is going on? I couldn't make hide nor hair of it. Someone here from Australia, did you also find this weird queuing thing, that they queue in weird ways here? Yeah, and now I know how to queue, still resent it. But, Jess, what are you going to say?
I think there's some ways in which... So I think we learn our social contracts from watching and joining in, right, generally, and being like, you know, effectively not wanting to upset anyone, but also wanting to fit in and wanting to feel upset and actually feeling upset by what I've noticed. Oh, it's a bit like my feelings about litter. Like, a lot of my feelings are... They're not voluntary. And there's somewhere, I think it's really interesting. I'm watching the social contract change, but it hasn't stopped. It doesn't mean I like it. And I'm trying to, I constantly, every time it happens, here's one. I think the social contract has changed on public transport in the UK about not using headphones if you're watching something loud or listening to music.
100%.
But it's just become something that just happens
subtle,
now.
Yeah.
And it's so loud and it fucks me off because it feels so rude, like it's so selfish, it's so individualistic. But I do wonder whether, and I don't pipe up about it because I think, oh god, are you that old that you mind? I think, am I offended by that? It's another, give it another month and I'm going to be upset about rap music. Do you know what I mean? Like, is it my, I feel like that began as a young person's rebellion against the establishment, against the man, against authority, against arbitrary rule. I don't know, that felt like a teenager's way of, to me, but maybe I'm wrong, I don't know. So I think maybe it just needs to run its course. But I mean, I'm inches away from, when it's a middle-aged couple, I think, you want a kick. Everyone can hear that. Everyone else can hear that. I'm trying to concentrate. I'm trying to relax. I'm trying, like, I don't know.
Yeah, no,
we all have an arrangement to sort of pretend we're all, each other aren't there.
Well, there's also a thing of the social contract being, don't stand up on a train and go, hey, we're all trying to read our own things, or, you know, and it's really loud. And as an Australian, again, sometimes I will try and do it in a charming way. Often British people sit on it until they boil over, and then they get really angry and they go, will you turn off? Whereas I cut it off at the pass. I think I see that happening. And there was a kid on a train, and his thing was kept going, good job, uh-oh, good job, uh-oh.
Oh, no.
And it was, we got on in London and we were going to Edinburgh.
Did the child survive?
And people were tutting for England, and for England being the operative country.
Yeah.
So I just stood up and said, oh, excuse me. And he was sitting a seat away from his dad. And I said to his dad, I said, oh, would your son have any headphones? And he went, he can put them on if he wants. He doesn't have to. And so I said to the little boy, do you have any headphones? Could you put them on? And I was really, really nice. And I said, it's just a quite a long trip to Edinburgh. And the man said, well, we're getting off at York. I was like, oh my God, and everyone went, York! Like that. But everyone loved that I did say something and gave it a college try. Kirsty, explain the phenomenon we are experiencing.
It's tempting to say that this is something new that's happening since lockdown. I've heard a lot of people suggest that maybe we've forgotten how to behave. But actually, this has been going on for a very long time. And I don't want to get too nerdy, but...
Please do.
I trace the roots of what I call the disconnection economy, that system of political and social media and capitalism that together has been conspiring into encouraging us into individualistic modes of thinking about ourselves and our own needs rather than communitarian models of thinking about what is best for everybody collectively, that really started to worsen around the 1970s with the rise of that neoliberal system, Margaret Thatcher's famous soundbite, there's no such thing as society.
It's Thatcher's fault that people don't have headphones on the train.
But it's individualism then, because it is, isn't it? It's the same thing. I hadn't put that together, but like playing your, like you're watching your
bad job.
Bad job. Or like I was on a train recently to all the way to Scotland, there, and some just a couple were just watching an action film full volume, and it was like,
oh fuck it!
Whoa! I got it!
Fucking Thatcherites.
Also,
it's the same thing as dropping litter. Like the idea is, I'm the only person here, or someone has a job to deal with that. Yeah. Like it's as if you are alone on this universe. Mm. The same mindset, isn't it?
I say to people if they've dropped litter in Camden, and it's, Camden's my patch, so I wouldn't say it in the West End, but in Camden I feel this is my living room. So do you know what I say? Oh, I think you've dropped this, and I give it back to them. And I've a social contract. They never ever look me in the eye and go, "No, I meant to." They go, "Oh, sorry, did I?" And then they put it in their pocket or their bag. Because it's a kind, charming way, I think, if a little passive-aggressive, of going, not...
And then do you, Debs, do you follow them and go, "And now say sorry?" or how do you let it go?
I'm not paying them £5,000 not to litter.
Fair play, yeah.
It's a lot of work. And I feel
just a little...
If you gave
me £5,000, I bet they'd stop dropping the litter.
It's a lot of money for me. And it's just a little...
It's a lot of money for anyone.
It's a fucking little, you know...
But there is a tendency to think about social censure and judgment and shame as if they are purely bad things that we must resist doing to each other, particularly other than tutting in the UK. But... what I look at in the book is the moment
is it
when
worse to
those things are actually
or to go,
academically speaking,
dinosaur noises are more reasonable than tutting.
Doctor Sedgman
taking the passive out of the aggressive.
But actually, shame can be really good. In fact, it's a necessary social tool.
In fact, the
entire evolution of human society goes back around about 10,000 years ago to the development not just of tools, but of pro-social rules and norms. Mm. The idea that actually on balance, probably it's better to trust that stranger in the distance rather than shoot him with a poisoned arrow. That was only possible, and our ability to live collectively together in complex societies was only possible because we decided that we were going to put in place shared social norms, along with mechanisms for calling out people when those norms are broken. But I also called somebody out on a train fairly recently because they were getting, and it was a group of teenage boys, there was a baby crying and they were getting very performatively, loudly angry at the baby.
Oh,
and it was escalating into abusive language. And I turned around.
Fuck the baby.
But I guess what they were trying to do was shame that mother into, I don't know what, hurling the baby out of the window.
Putting headphones on it.
I turned around to him. And said, "You don't know how hard it is to be a mother." And to his credit, he apologised.
Yeah.
Can I get his number? I'd like to hear an apology. Sorry, I let that escalate. It's one of those things. Can I ask, in your book, you talk about the stats about sexual violence against women and the injustice that's there. Can you unpack a little bit about what you found as an academic about the origins of this?
Of course. So in recent years, rape reports around the world have been increasing exponentially, but rape convictions have remained relatively static, and that's called the justice gap. So I started to look into why this is. And one of the things that I found is that when the legal system... the international legal system was being developed, they needed to figure out a way of applying what seems like rigid rules to actually very variable sets of social circumstances. Figuring out who did what to whom within what context is not as black and white as it appears. So they reached for an old philosophical word, and that word was reasonable. They invented what's called the reasonable standard of judgment, and that's applied in courtrooms around the world today. But in its earliest iteration, it was called the reasonable man standard.
Our audience hasn't enjoyed that.
And my problem here is not with men. It's not even with the upper middle class, white, rich men who tended to make up the elite and whose judgments were considered to be the only reasonable ones. Mm-hmm. It's the idea that that one tiny segment of society should be equipped to be the ultimate objective arbiter of judgment of everybody else. And I explore in the book all the ways that this plays out, from the idea of the reasonable doubt, which is in murder trials. That use of reasonable is, of course, central there, to that infamous get cops out of jail free card, the reasonable use of force, but also how reasonableness has played out in cases of sexual violence against women. Mm. And what I find is that time and time again, those supposedly reasonable judgments tend to have lent themselves to victim blaming because of centuries of, we call them schemata, basically stories that have been told about women as the evil temptresses, from Eve to the Chang dynasties, incubi, these stories that have been told about women as if they are corrupting men who are hapless and can't help themselves. And I've got a lovely list from a letter written by a Benedictine monk called Peter Damian in 1064. He sent his fellow clergymen a long list of all the things that he believed women were like. So, ladies, and anyone who wants to, tag yourselves. Appetizers of the devil. Venom of mimes, poison of drinkers, toxin of banqueters, screech owls, wolves, leeches, whores, prostitutes, lovers, mad vipers who, because of impatience of the burning lust of your loves, mutilate Christ, wallows of greasy pigs. And women were seen as such a threat, because as Peter Damian pointed out, for a very long time, women were believed to be corrupting men's souls by seducing them into having sex with them. Which is why we can see those ancient, wrong-headed, supposedly reasonable beliefs cropping up in courtrooms again and again around the world that tend to blame women and let the male perpetrators, who are always promising young men with bright futures ahead of them, off the hook. That doesn't sound too reasonable to me.
What hearing that list has done is it once is it made me want to start a feminist gang called Mad Vipers. We could get jackets. It'd be cool.
Oh, yeah.
But the book really goes into all sorts of... There's a chapter called Fuck Civility, but it's about the way that groups who have fought for social progress, they can't just go, well, we'll meet you at what is reasonable now. You kind of have to create a new reasonable through social progress. And some of those ways are involve things that are revolution or, you know, you have to go out in the street and you have to appear very unreasonable. So interesting. And if you, I really recommend that you read the book, because what is reasonable... What is reasonable in the social contract is what we've all decided is reasonable, and sometimes the people that are most important in a certain conversation didn't get to decide what was reasonable within that. One thing I do want to ask you, though, is I feel like there's a lot of unreasonableness, so especially on social media, someone will say something, someone else will come in and go, well, you shouldn't say that because the first person will get a bit defensive, and then it will escalate so unreasonably, so quickly, and instead of sort of chatting someone through something or walking someone who's effectively on your side, instead of walking someone through it and letting them disagree for a while and think about it. Sometimes people don't, they're proud and they don't want to say right away, but instead of saying, look, I think one technique that I've used in the past is go, look, I thought that, I didn't understand it either, but I read this and I thought it was really interesting, and I think if you read it, you might change your mind. You might not, but you might. And I feel like this is my reasonable person technique of like, I, a reasonable person, change my mind. You might too. But I also do want to allow some space for plurality. What if they read it and they don't change their mind? I don't want everyone who's on my team to just think exactly the same as me about everything. So where's the other side of this, which is reasonable doesn't have to mean everybody agreeing with you about everything either, does it?
It doesn't. And one of the big things that I know could be a risk of writing a book like this is I might be seen to be claiming to be the ultimate arbiter of reasonableness, the only person in the world who is able to tell everybody else what is right and what is wrong.
Oh, the good, point then that in that case, what do you think about my dentist story? You could be the judge.
I think you should yell at her.
Oh, it's official.
Yeah, I definitely wasn't a frozen vote there. But
international arbiter of reasonableness.
But I'm
says,
not.
But no, of course you're not.
Because
yes,
we're talking about some of the most complex issues of social relations here. Mm. We want to live in this multi-generational, multicultural democracy. Mm-hmm. But we have all of these competing views and ideas, and we have all of these forces that are deliberately trying to pull us apart. And social media is a big part of that problem. I call it the bait and bitch technique.
Bait and bitch?
Yeah, not bait and switch.
Ah.
It's a clever pun. Okay, maybe it wasn't that clever.
No, it is a good pun. It is a good pun.
And what that means is that we know that social media is designed more often than not to encourage dissenting voices, to encourage dissensus and angry debate, because that's where the big bucks are. There's much more money to be made from encouraging hate than there is encouraging healthy and nourishing forms of conversation.
Why is that? Just because you stay on longer if you're angry with someone and then you see more ads?
Yeah, and there's so many.
More quickly.
There's so much research that shows that engagement farming really does work. Hate clicks.
It spreads more quickly than any other emotion across.
Tend to want to click on things or to write about things that make them angry because they want to publicly disagree. And also, one of the things that I talk about is the fact that we are being hit with so much information now more than ever, and it can be really confusing and actually quite distressing. We're seeing more information than our grandparents would, I think, in, well, quite a long time. And we're seeing that every day beamed into our eyeballs. So having an opinion and publicly affirming that opinion, often on social media, can be a way to, I argue, restore that sense of order in a chaotic universe and also fight
and
for
powerful,
the social contract as you see it.
Yes, yeah. And feel heard and...
Yeah, and try to make society better. But we also have seen the dark side of that in the infamous Karen videos, for example, when somebody has that strong sense of reasonable self-righteousness and is approaching somebody, usually it's a white woman approaching a person of colour, and shaming them as if they're the manager of that social space. And that terrifying thrill of reasonableness in the eyes has been judged by so many people around the world to be manifestly unreasonable because they're causing harm and making judgments based on bias.
So what...
Can I reasonably point out your
10 minutes
over?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
The battery went, Tom.
Yeah, so just very quickly...
And I'm not sure actually
this is
that's
the last
reasonable
thing,
in my social...
But is there any hope for us?
Yes.
Oh, God, imagine if you said no.
What's the hope?
You left a little dangly moment there, and I...
Yeah.
I was nervous.
It's true, you paused for too long. What's the hope that we can take away from your book?
The hope is that we are living in a society. I believe in society. I believe that humans, broadly speaking, are more good and collaborative and cooperative than we are combative. We've been incentivized into divisions. And what we need to do is ask ourselves not should we do away with rules altogether. I call those people the unreasonably unreasonable people, people who feel that they should be able to smash things and get their own way and take whatever they want, no matter the harm to anyone else. We want to censure and shame those people. But also, I worry that a lot of us are so worried of seeming like them that we've become something not worse, but maybe just as bad. And those people I call unreasonably reasonable, obsessed with tone policing and endless toothless debate, cultivating the appearance of reasonableness, whilst actually allowing morally unjust things to pass. And what history shows us, as I carefully unpick in the book, is that history has always relied on the reasonably unreasonable people, people who know that sometimes under the right kinds of circumstances, we need to give other people permission to pull down statues and to shut down hate speech. Because only then are we going to move forwards together towards true social progress.
Thank you. Dr. Kirsty Sedgman, it's been an absolute honour. I would recommend everyone buy and read On Being Unreasonable. The paperback has a cross-looking bunny on the front, so how can you resist
it.
That?
It's
it would be unreasonable
cover.
Of you not to buy it. No, it's really, really, really is interesting. And it's good to think these things apart sometimes. I think we get locked in a very unhealthy, rigid way of going, no one can go forward unless this, and then we're all not going to go forward yet. So I think this book is a really useful tool in rethinking how to be unreasonably reasonable. Kirsty, this is what you came to plug, I assume.
It is.
Anything else to plug?
Only to say that the reason I was so excited to come on this podcast is my husband's massive fan, listened to Guilty Feminist for years. First episode he ever listened to, he burst into the kitchen and he said, Kirsty, have you heard about this thing called the gender pay gap? Yeah. I was like, yes, I've been telling you about this for years. So we have a running joke that if I want him to listen to me, I just need to go on the Guilty Feminist. So now I'm here, I'm just going to spend the next 2 hours listing all the things that I want you to listen to Tom. The boys' PE days this term on Monday and Thursday.
Brilliant. Excellent. Dr. Kirsty Sedgman, everybody. Woo-hoo! Absolutely brilliant. What a brilliant guest. Jess Foster Q, have you got anything to plug?
I've got two things to plug. I forgot one of them in the last episode. I've got two things to plug. My last show, Wench, is out as a special. Oh. And it's out on the 26th of January, but you can already pre-order it and it's pay what you want to stream it. And I'm on tour with a brand new show called Metal all over the UK and Ireland, and I'd really love to have Guilty Feminist listeners in my audiences. Hopefully it's coming somewhere near where you live.
Nice. Very, very excited. Please go along to all of those.
If you're here in
things.
London, it's at the Leicester Square Theatre in June. It's also at Soho Theatre in February, but the thing is sold out.
Oh, very good. You've been an absolutely fantastic audience. I'm just going to say a big thank you to everyone at King's Place. Sorry, we've run over a bit. Thank you to Dr. Kirsty Sedgman. And thank you to the incredible Jessica Foster Q. You have been listening to The Guilty Feminist with me, Deborah Brussels-White, guest host, Jess Foster Q, and our very special guest, Dr. Kirsty Sedgman. The recording engineer was Chris Sharp. The Guilty Feminist theme tune was composed by Mark Hodge. The producer was Tom Selinsky for the Spotted Alien Shop. Thanks to Rachel Croft and Gina Lisa, Zainab Mahmoud, and everyone at King's Place, as well as all of you for listening. For more information about this and other episodes, visit guiltyfeminist.com. Well, Olga Cox should take it to the dragons. It's her game. Olga Cox's already taken it to the dragons. And
I think we helped develop
they've
it.
They've already... Yeah, well, of course, we are a part of the development package because of our excellent work on it. Deborah Meaden's already signed up for 5% of... I'm over my... Olga Cox is my... I'm over my ex.
Yeah.
Only...
she's given us 10 mil for just 2% of the business.
Yeah.
It was the most successful pitch that's ever been on the Den.
Yeah. I mean, it is quite a fun game. I think we're all going to be playing it for ages. I bet it helps, though. I bet it does. Because then you just think, well, how should I have I made that happen?
Good. Mm-hmm. Do you know, like when you wake up and you go, have I dreamed that? Or has it happened? It's a bit like that.
Disappointing moments with John
Hamm.
That
little moment.
No, I have a number of times I thought we were really good friends or out on a date. Then you wake up and you go,
friends.
Oh, I think it's finally happened. And then it turns out. So.
Hasn't again.
All right. I'm going to say live from King's Place in London. Yeah. You've got a break of spontaneous applause. Ready?
The Guilty Feminist is provided exclusively from Acast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.